I just love meeting with founders and people that are trying to build businesses, talking with them about how they're doing and how they're thinking about it, and then ultimately betting on them to be successful. And it's extremely rewarding. It's obviously risky, but I've been fortunate enough over the last few years to build a platform and a business off of it that's been good to me.
Welcome to What's Next with Eric Wood. Our next guest is Joe Pompliano, and Joe is an entrepreneur and investor. He is one of the fastest growing personalities in sports and has built a massive audience on social platforms, telling stories mainly on the business end of sport, and is honestly one of my favorite follows on social media. Joe now spends the majority of his time identifying and supporting great founders through early stage investment opportunities, and has a daily newsletter called Huddle Up that I encourage you to subscribe to. If you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you tune in weekly. And also, if you haven't already, go to Amazon and order my book, Tackle What's Next. And the link to that is in the show notes. Thanks and enjoy. Joe, welcome to the podcast, brother.
Hey, man, how are you? Thank you for having me.
I'm doing great. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. So as I was preparing for this, there's so many different directions that I could go and want to pick your brain on. But I really want to know, since you've made a name for yourself in the sports world through telling stories that you tell and you're investing, but I want to know what type of athlete Joe Pompliano is or was.
Very mediocre. I always joke that, like, every kid growing up, especially young boys, right? Like, your dream is to go play professional sports, especially if you're into it at a young age. And I have four brothers, so that was certainly on my radar. I played football, basketball, baseball growing up, and then everything else you could imagine too, right? Air hockey, ping pong, whatever, anything to get outside. So I loved sports growing up, and it was very fun, but I unfortunately wasn't good enough to do anything past high school. So the next best thing to me was to be involved in sports in another capacity, right? So at first I thought I wanted to be a sports agent. And as someone who's been around the NFL for a long time, I'm sure you know how difficult that business is, not only from, like, you know, people that are doing it today, but also just breaking in. It's incredibly difficult. And I worked at Octagon Sports Agency for a short period of time in college. And I realized pretty early on that that was going to be a difficult choice and career path. So I went a couple different ways. I worked in finance in New York, spent 4 or 5 years at JP Morgan on the wealth management side, trading fixed income. And then I fell back into it, man. I love sports so much. I was just always talking to my friends about it, talking to my wife about it, talking to family members about stuff. And, you know, it was just born out of passion. It was like, hey, if I can go write about some of this stuff, if I can build an audience on Twitter, it'll give me leverage to do all the other stuff that I want to do, which is investing and everything outside of that. So I've been doing it for a few years now, but it was more of a passion for sports than it was certainly from athletic ability.
And we'll get back to that in 1 second. You mentioned being an agent, and what people don't realize, there's a non-glamorous side of being an agent. It's a, hey, me and my girlfriend broke up, can you go get my stuff out of another city for me? And then you mentioned a tough, it's a tough world to break into, especially when you're coming out of college, because you could have been excellent. But to me, it's, man, this is my future. Almost just like when you were at JP Morgan, it's tough to get clients, especially when you're young, because you think, well, they don't have the experience. And although I trust this guy, man, this is my livelihood. Well, the same way in sport, unless you have that long runway of previous clients and all of that. I had David Mulgeta, super agent, who seems to sign 10 first rounders a year for Athletes First. Now, he did the fully guaranteed Deshaun Watson deal, had him on the podcast. And it was unique, his story, because he was buddies with Jamal Charles and a number of guys from Texas that all hired him early. So now he's got this big client base. If you don't have that, it becomes very tough to break into the agent world.
Yeah, I was just going to add that that is certainly helpful. And the other thing too is I almost liken it to like med school to some degree. My brother went to med school, and most people know that you can work 10, 12 years before you really get to go out on your own and start making real money as a surgeon or something like that, right? The difference is as a agent, you're doing that till you're 30, 35 years old. And unless you're like the top 1 to 3 to 4% of agents, you're really not making all that much money anyways. So there's a bunch of other ways that you can be involved in sports that are potentially more lucrative that you can get started on on very early. And that's what I realized when I was looking at the landscape. And, you know, like you said, it's a tough business, especially now today when we see all of these players. The cool thing to do is, right, do a contract without an agent.
Right.
And so the business is changing, but I'm certainly happy with what I ended up doing.
Yeah, that could be a totally different podcast in the pros and cons of having an agent.
I tweeted out Laramie Tunzels, and I had like three or four agents hitting me up like, well, what you didn't realize is this and this and this. And, you know, everyone's trying to protect the status quo. And I don't necessarily think it's going to change. I just think that, you know, the business and what players want evolves over time. And this is just another example of that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So when you make that pivot to go from a job that is more traditional to something that is way less traditional, especially a few years ago, what was the reaction from family and friends?
So it's two parts. My family and friends were completely understanding. Like, the easiest thing to think about is that everyone should be surrounding themselves with people that are just genuinely rooting for them to be happy, successful, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So they were the ones actually pushing me to do it sooner. And they were the ones that were very, very, very supportive. And I actually work with my wife now, right? So like that whole dynamic has been incredible. I think the work part of it was more interesting because coming from a traditional finance background, and especially the job that I had, right? I was working at JP Morgan, which is one of, if not the largest bank in the world. In New York City, I was, you know, in my early 20s, making good money, working long hours. And by all accounts, it's a job that a lot of people would want. And I wasn't naive to that, which was the reason why they were so confused when I said I was leaving, right? I was, I've told this story maybe a couple times now, but when I first started doing a lot of this stuff, I was waking up, I was still working at JP Morgan. I just started the newsletter and started tweeting. I had no online presence at all. And I would wake up in the morning, I'd write the newsletter at 5:30 in the morning. I'd go to work at 7:30. I'd work all day, whatever, working long hours, 6, 7, 8 PM at night. Then I would do it again the next day, right? And I was tweeting a couple times throughout the day. And when I was at the office, I would literally go to the bathroom and tweet from there. And it was just like this crazy cycle of me trying to figure out how to speed things up and do it quicker. So when I told them that I was leaving, most of them were, you know, supportive and appreciative and wanted to see how it went. But my boss at the time, he just like couldn't grasp what I was trying to do, right? He's like, wait, you're going to be a writer, right? Like he was just like, you're working in finance. Like, what do you mean? And it just like was a completely unknown topic to them, the possibilities that could go from there, right? Like when you build an audience, you can certainly make income off of that from a writing perspective. You can do advertising, you can do sponsorships, you can do investing, you can do all these different things. And ultimately that's what it's become. And a lot of them have reached out since and been like, dude, this is awesome and really supportive. But I certainly think it took them a bit of time to understand what was happening.
Yeah. And I appreciate you making that jump. And, you know, oftentimes when you see someone that's in a position that you might want to get to, there's a certain amount of risk that is taken. There's a certain amount of unknown, but stepping into that unknown can get you to the point where you have something that you're very proud of, that you're passionate, that you're working for yourself now and not some big corporation.
I have a quick story on that, and it'll give you a little insight into why I made the decision. So, you know, Athletic Brewing? Athletic mm-hmm. Brewing is non-alcoholic beer, right?
Yep.
And I swear I'm not just plugging sponsors over here because we actually don't work together right now. But
you're good. I have a Dano seasoning T-shirt on. You're all good.
So I'm getting to the point. I promise. When I was at JP Morgan, I had started doing this. I had like 10 or 15,000 subscribers on the newsletter, maybe 25,000, something in that range. Moderately successful, but by no means sustainable from a business perspective. And I went to Bill Schufelt, who is the owner and CEO and founder of Athletic Brewing. And I said, hey, look, man, here's what's going on. Here's what I've done over the last few months. Here's the growth rates. Here's where I think everything can go. I want to do a 6-month sponsorship deal. You guys are going to be the exclusive sponsor of everything that I do online. Twitter threads, newsletters, podcasts, whatever I do, you guys will be the sponsor of. I will push your product like hell. I just need to make X amount of money and I'll leave my job. And Bill said yes. Right? Like literally all it took was one person to understand what I was trying to do, have empathy for the situation, right? See the business perspective of it where, hey, look, maybe I get a good deal for the first 2 months and then he'll get a good deal for the last 3 or 4, right? Depending on growth rates and stuff. So I looked at it as, hey, if I have this opportunity, this is 10 times more than most people have when they're trying to de-risk their life and figure out what they want to do for their career. So it became a no-brainer, and it became something where, like, if I didn't do it, I knew ultimately I would regret it. And I can't obviously thank them enough for that, but ultimately it was just an easy decision because of that.
Wow. Yeah, that's powerful. And oftentimes it takes someone believing in you. It takes some powerful words at times that gives you the confidence to step out. I appreciate you sharing that. That was powerful. And I love that they stepped behind you. And I do remember the early stages of them being the main sponsor. And now you see a lot more in different affiliations that you may have now. But that's a really cool story. And so These stories that you tell, they are all unique in nature. How do you uncover these? How do you select which ones you're going to get to?
It's a good question. Everyone asked me this, and I don't really have a great answer because I just love this stuff, you know, man. Like, yeah. I constantly am reading, watching, learning, and I just enjoy it, right? So naturally, you come upon stuff that is interesting. I get reached out. People reach out to me about stuff all the time, things they want to either promote or get out there. So that's certainly one avenue. But I try to just do things that are interesting to me, right? And I always do it with the, look, I have a business to run on the back end of this. There's a newsletter, there's podcasts, there's all this stuff that needs to grow from it. But ultimately, what I've tried to do is just provide value. I've tried to say, hey, if I build an audience based on the fact that they just enjoy this content as much as I enjoy it, that'll be incredibly valuable in the end. And that's worked well. Like, when I tweet, I literally just tweet because I think this stuff is interesting and I like talking about it and I like conversing with people and building a community and friends off of it. And I think that's been really helpful when I think about the growth of all the platforms.
What's the end goal in this for you?
I want to become certainly the biggest sports business personality in the world. I think that what I have the ability to do is leverage a lot of these 21st century digital platforms like Twitter, YouTube, certainly podcasts, email newsletters, etc., to build that platform. I think I'm certainly on my way there already. But ultimately, I just want to do something that I enjoy doing, right, for the rest of my life. And when people say, I get approached by people, as you can imagine, all the time that want to start creating content online, whether it's sports or something else. They just want to start building an audience, talking about things they care about, whatever it is. And the number one thing I always say is that you have to literally be willing to do it for the rest of your life because there's no point in starting if you're not that committed to it because you'll give up. It sucks sometimes, right? In the early days of this, and even now to some degree, I was working way more than I was at JP Morgan. And it doesn't always feel rewarding. Sometimes you get knocked down, you make mistakes, people make fun of you, you put yourself out there. But ultimately, you have to be willing to do it for the rest of your life, because that's what's going to make the difference. It's long-term games with long-term people. And I truly believe that if you have that mindset, I'm not unique. You know, this can be done by anyone.
Yeah, it could be, but you have kind of solidified your footprint in this now, where it'd be tough to duplicate based upon what you've done. I didn't have this in my notes, but as you were mentioning the different platforms, for someone that has over 500,000 followers on Twitter, and where that might not seem astronomical to some, when you're not a professional athlete, when you're not a big time celebrity, that is a monster following, and you don't have a big publication behind you as well, pushing you out there. So I want to commend you on that. One, it's very impressive what you've built there. But two, is there any fear that what happens if Twitter goes away?
Yeah, certainly. And I think that's a big part of why I've always thought the newsletter was the most critical piece of what I was doing, right? Because I own, to some degree, the entire business, right? It's me. There's no publication. I write everything myself. I own all of it. I get to control content and distribution, all that type of stuff. But there's definitely platform risk, whether it's Twitter going away, Instagram going away, the podcast feed, you own the RSS, but you know that could become less popular, YouTube, et cetera. So what I've tried to do from the very beginning was use and leverage these platforms to build an audience that I can control and own, which is the email. So from the very beginning, when I started writing the newsletter, I became really active on Twitter. And that's where I decided to try to build the biggest platform possible because there's a virality to Twitter, right? You can share things get retweeted, they get seen by bigger people with bigger audiences, and you can build a following that way. But the end goal was always to filter people down into the newsletter, because that's something that you can proactively reach out on. You own that audience, et cetera. And I think that's where you protect yourself a bit from the platform risk, because it's just like any other media publication then, right? You're sending newsletters, you can send them podcasts, you can send them other videos, you get to talk to them and have that relationship. And I think it's only becoming more popular. We've seen some of these platforms, like I use Substack, and they're building out chat features, and they're building out polls and videos and podcasts. And I think from a creative perspective, the tools are actually just getting stronger, and the risk is getting mitigated because of that. You're de-risking a little bit because there's so many different things now. So what you try to do is you try to build something that you own from the jump, and then immediately you just try to expand into other stuff where there's less risk, right? Because if you're just Twitter goes down, you're kind of screwed. If you're Twitter, podcast, YouTube, Instagram, newsletter, you de-risk it a little bit, and now you're able to build a more sustainable business.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I want to ask you and your brothers have gotten into a lot of investing. And if you don't mind, maybe share a couple of success stories that you've had along the way. But regardless, when you're looking at a specific investment, which is interesting because you've gotten into some sports investments as well, combining your sports with your also financial background as well. But when you're looking at startup or early stage companies, what are some things that you're honing in on or focusing on the most?
It's a great question. I appreciate it. So when I first started thinking about building an audience, it wasn't always just about building a newsletter and a following and becoming famous. Like, that stuff I don't really care about. I was building the audience to gain leverage, and I wanted leverage for investing. So when I was working at JP Morgan, me and my brothers had done some early stage investing, certainly in kind of traditional financial markets, but also we had gotten involved in some of the early crypto stuff. We invested in Coinbase and Bitcoin and some stuff like that. And that industry was a little bit easier because it wasn't established. But outside of that, it's really difficult to get in on some of these deals. It's all an access game. You have to know someone that's investing in the deal. You have to know the founders. You have to have some type of in. So what I wanted to do, and what me and my brothers have tried to do over the last few years, is build an audience that gives us a competitive advantage. So if you're a business and you're a founder, you want me to invest in your product or your company because I'm going to give you access to all the distribution that I have now, right? I did 2 billion impressions on Twitter last year.
Wow.
When I tweet about your business, or when I put your business through podcast ads or newsletter ads or whatever it is, it can make a meaningful inflection point in the trajectory of your business. So I've tried to build it over time as leverage, less than about the revenue from the actual content side. And you're right, like, it's enabled us to invest in some great businesses. We've certainly done some later stage stuff, but on the early stage side, I did the PLL, right? The Premier Lacrosse League. I did Underdog Fantasy, which is the sports betting app. We've done a variety of different things, and it's introduced me to a bunch of different people too, right? Because I don't have a mandate where I have to invest a certain amount of capital every year. I don't have a mandate where I have to do specific industries or specific stages. I just love meeting with founders and people that are trying to build businesses, talking with them about how they're doing and how they're thinking about it, and then ultimately betting on them to be successful. And it's extremely rewarding. It's obviously risky, but I've been fortunate enough over the last few years to build a platform and a business off of it that's been good to me.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really wise as well. Leverage your audience to gain access. And I feel like so many people are gaining this audience, but not ever capitalizing on it, other than maybe some paid ads. I heard Rob Dyrdek recently talking about how he built this audience for so long, but then he basically just gave it all away to DC Shoes or whoever it was. And Now he's looking for equity whenever he's doing anything to be able to leverage that audience now.
Well, when you think about it too, people with audience, you'll always make more money by building the products and services yourself and having a meaningful stake in them versus just doing traditional ads. It certainly can be lucrative either way, but there's countless examples. Logan Paul is a good example, right? He has this huge audience on YouTube and other platforms. He can get paid seven figures by advertising deals and YouTube ad revenue and stuff like that. But what does he do? He goes out and he partners with another YouTuber and builds Prime, the energy drink and hydration company. And they're going to make hundreds of millions of dollars off of that.
Right? Yeah, they did 6 million bottles day one, I believe. believe.
Yeah. I think they did $250 million last year in sales, right?
Wow.
And, you know, whether you want to give it a 5x multiple or 10x multiple, that's a $1 billion business. And they probably own, you know, I have no idea, but I'm assuming each of them probably owns like more than 15% because they're going on press tours. They're promoting it heavily, right? So they probably own a good chunk of it. So he's going to make hundreds of millions of dollars versus probably low to mid seven figures for sponsorship deals. And it's all because he used his distribution and popularity to own equity in a product and increase the sales of that. And I think that's ultimately where we're headed, is people are realizing that the audience is the currency, right? That is what is valuable to the products and services that are out there in the marketplace today. And I think he's probably the perfect example of that.
I can't wait to read your Twitter thread on that breakdown one day when all those numbers are finalized and that company either sells or they pull out some equity in that one.
My guess is that they probably get acquired within the next 24 months.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Yeah, when you're one of these bigger brands, conglomerates like PepsiCo or someone like that, you're basically just de-risking your business a little bit by acquiring someone up relatively cheap, given their market position and their total annual revenue. And it's a win-win for them too, right? They work on something for 3-4 years at a time. They get a meaningful exit from it, then they can move on and do whatever they want. So I think it'll probably be sooner than later.
Yeah, I would imagine so too. You're one of the reasons I enjoy following you so much is that generally everything's positive. It's promoting individuals, it's promoting companies, it's promoting leagues. You mentioned the Laremy Tunsil situation catching a little bit of backlash from the agents. Do you often catch backlash from your posts, or do people oftentimes just appreciate what you're putting out there?
Yeah, I'm pretty upfront and honest about it. I don't like doing negative stuff, right? Like I'm a positive person by nature, and I appreciate talking about that sort of thing. I also think that growing up in and around sports, I've realized over time that athletes can be put in a bad light for a lot of things, when in reality, they have an incredible opportunity, especially today with the audiences that they have and the attention that they have, to make a meaningful impact, not only for their families, but for the world in general. So I try to certainly look at the positive side of a lot of things. You're not going to hear me saying, hey, look, this is how much money this guy lost on an investment. You're not going to hear me saying, you know, this person's an idiot for doing this. There's plenty of places out there that will do that. You'll be able to find that news. I more want to talk about positive stories, things that are inspiring, things that are rewarding, and make meaningful connections that way, right? Because I think for a long period of time, we've looked at athletes in a different light. And I certainly want to be a part of changing that mentality. And look, it's not that everything is always amazing. There's things that go wrong. There's things that I'll certainly tweet out regardless, but it's more about your opinion on the situation and how you frame things and how you word it. If you look at media today, we've certainly turned further away from kind of these long form communication styles that are nuanced and people are able to get their voices out and tell all details. And we've turned into, like, how many aggregation accounts do you see on Twitter today that are essentially just putting one line from an article that intentionally is there to get people riled up or share, right? Like, it happens literally all the time.
Right.
And that's the type of stuff that I try to stray away from, because one, I don't think it's helpful, but I don't think it's sustainable either if you're trying to build a brand, because people realize that all it takes is people seeing it one time from you. Maybe the first 3 to 4 times they don't look into it and they just take it at face value and they're like, okay, this person's aggregating. But if you do it and you do it and you do it, eventually someone's going to see it and they're going to realize it, and then they're never going to want to look at your stuff again. And that, to me, is how you play this game for a long time. I'm, 28 years old. So I hope to be doing this for a long period of time. And my guess is that by being honest and true and positive, that enables me to do that.
Yeah, I love your mindset on that. And I appreciate that direction that you want to take. And I do believe that's sustainable. And by not crushing relationships either,
that's a big part of it.
You leave your windows open constantly to be able to just continue to broaden, as opposed to shutting yourself off as soon as you alienate one league, team, individual, whoever it may be. That individual is tied to an agency who has other athletes as well, and that could be detrimental to your brand going forward. Let me pick your brain on a few things. I know nobody has a crystal ball, but when you look at the landscape of the NFL, and they have teams playing, the Bills in particular, I'll be calling a game in London this year, so they're playing games outside the U.S. The Bills, at one point, were rumored to maybe being bought by Bon Jovi and a group that wanted to move them to Toronto. When you look at the next 5 to 10 years, do you envision there being a team or multiple teams outside of the U.S.?
I don't think so. This has become a hot topic over the last few years, and I almost feel like it's trending. More people believe it will happen than it won't, because the NFL has been, people don't realize the NFL has been doing international games for basically its entire existence. There was preseason games in the 1900s that were, abroad. There were, we obviously had the NFL International League at some point. Now they're doing the London series. They do Mexico. They're doing Germany. And I think part of it is that they're trying to grow the game internationally. But to have a team there is very difficult because just logistically speaking, if we want to start there, if you have a franchise there, they have to spend numerous weeks on the road at a time because you're probably going to play several games in a row. Right. And then each team has to go travel there, which is a nightmare in itself. And you're not really building a true fan base because it's just one team, not a variety of teams. So people only have one option. You could do a European league, which is, or a division, which is, 3, 4, 5 teams, something like that, and make them in either London or somewhere else. But again, I think that does the novelty wear off, right? Like, the numbers are great for the couple times a year they go out there. And actually, the numbers in Germany were very good from a television perspective, even before they went there. But I just think that we're a ways away from that happening. The NFL is at the point now where also from a talent perspective, you're not going to move teams for teams from a city, right? So you'd have to either expand or maybe a combination of both. I don't think they're going to expand. The talent level isn't there right now to be able to do that. So I just think when you look at everything in aggregate, it's probably not likely. But I would caveat all of this with the fact that 10 years is a long time, right? And some of this stuff can go quicker than you think. Like if you ask me about the NBA, I'd be like, yeah, they're for sure going to expand 2 more teams within the next 10 years. I just think that's probably going to happen within the next 5 or 6 years. But with the NFL, you just don't know. It's such a huge business here in America. There's an amazing opportunity to go international with it, given the relatively small size that we see outside of the United States today and how popular it is here. I just think logistically, it's going to be pretty challenging to build a division outside of the U.S.
And those were all great points. And yes, the travel's awful. And that's what everyone has on their minds. But I like your point about, you're only giving them one option and then you move a division over there. You mentioned the talent. And look, the NFC can't even find quarterbacks right now. Yeah. Can you add more teams and add quarterbacks out there? Because the quarterback's the most important position in all of pro sports. If you don't have a quarterback, it's just so hard to be competitive. And are there enough good quarterbacks to make it entertaining? That's a really good point there.
I would ask you one question off of that too. When I interviewed Troy Aikman a while back, and he was
which was excellent.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. He made an interesting point about his concerns about the NFL. And he said his main concern was just that there's a lot of bad football being played. And he was specifically talking about last year. And, maybe the interview was halfway through the year. So even more specifically, the beginning half. And he referenced that a lot of the stuff that the players union is trying to do is to limit exposure on the field and stop injuries from happening and so forth. And the owners aren't willing to give up money in exchange for that kind of stuff, right? So they'd rather say, okay, you don't have to come to as many OTAs or as many training camp sessions or whatever it is. Do you think that is playing a role in the poor, whether it's quarterback player, just poor play in general?
I do. And I think it starts at the college level where the game is so much different from college to the NFL now. Now it is getting blended with mobile quarterbacks, some offensive coordinators coming to the NFL. You're seeing more spread concepts. But I think over the last 10 years, that played a big role, especially when you talk about offensive line play, quarterback play. And look, I know I'm a former offensive lineman, and I'm not saying that's what makes the team go. But if you have bad offensive line play, it's hard to do anything offensively. And then if you don't have good quarterback play. So those were the two positions affected the most by that differential between the college game and the NFL game. When you talk about the padded, when we talk about on-field exposure, the main thing is padded practices. It's very hard for most positions to replicate what you do during a game in practice if you don't have pads on. During the season, you're only allowed one padded practice per week for the first 11 weeks of the season, then all completely non-padded. All of OTAs completely non-padded. during training camp, you start off with like four non-padded practices. Then you can only have four practices, single days, as opposed to the old two-a-days, and then you have to get a day off. I explain all that to say it's not that much time in doing and practicing what you're doing on game day. It was very good for me when they put these in place. When I was a former first-round draft pick, I'm with the same team, and I have my spot in check. It's very hard then for someone to develop and take my position. That's why you have these older guys that are the player reps for all these teams that are sitting, when we were doing it in Hawaii when I was a player rep, voting on that. Yes, we will take that deal. And if you're not willing to give us more money, yes, I want to take less blows on my body. I want to extend my career. What we weren't thinking of was, man, this next generation could be affected because the game isn't as entertaining. Now, other people will point to, hey, the game's not as entertaining because the hits aren't there anymore. Well, the ratings continue to go up, and and for what can crush the game would be, in DeMar Hamlin's an outlying situation, but a Ryan Shazier moment, those moments of extreme brutality on the field that you actually get to witness what they're going through. You don't see us wake up in our beds the next morning when we feel like we got out of a car crash. That's shielded and that's all great. But when it's exposed on the field, that is not good for the game. So I heard Troy Aikman say that, and I appreciated it. And he knows as well as anybody. He covers the game on a week-to-week basis, plus was a Hall of Fame quarterback. And so he understands it greatly. And that is a concern moving forward when you talk about, I get in trouble saying this is the most popular sport in the world. It's not the most popular sport in the world. It's the most popular sport in our country, but watched around the world as well.
Most profitable league. That is exactly. That is for sure. So you're not wrong. But yeah, I agree. I think you're spot on about to the long-term future of the game, because when you think about the hits and specifically, you're right. People complain about it. They say, you know, we want bigger hits. The NFL was better when hits were allowed and so forth. But you open yourself up to long-term injuries for current players, which you obviously don't want, but also situations that are in the public eye, like a DeMar Hamlin, a Ryan Shazier, stuff like that. And when you look at the true health of the NFL and football in general, it's all driven grassroots football. It's driven by the youth, right? And we've seen over the last few years that youth participation in the sport has dropped pretty aggressively. Yep. And I think that is the biggest danger to the game. It's not existing fans not watching it because quarterback play is bad. I agree that could be better. And, you know, obviously you want the game to be as entertaining as possible. But if parents start saying, you can't play football, I don't want you to play football, it's not healthy, there's all these other things, that is where there's problems. I would caveat this with, I think the NFL has done a pretty good job about it, right? They built a flag football league. It's pretty big and popular. They're investing millions of dollars annually into the process, and that has ticked up. And essentially what they're saying is play flag football for a certain amount of time. When you get to high school, play tackle football. From there, you'll limit the amount of hits you're taking. You know, that you have a better chance of being healthy long-term. And I agree that's the right strategy, but ultimately it's a dangerous game, and that's why people like it. And you're always going to have some level of risk there. But I think the bigger concern with the NFL today is youth participation, not necessarily the level of play.
I agree 100% on that. So in Louisville, we have Louisville FC. We have a club program of youth underneath that is pulling kids out of football. So is lacrosse. So is a number of sports are pulling kids away from football. Well, then you have the opening weekend of the MLS. I may have seen this on one of your threads. I don't know exactly where I saw it. But you have Atlanta and Carolina, both with over 65,000 people in their football stadiums to watch professional soccer. Mm-hmm. Well, people only have so much time and so much money. And when soccer starts pulling, that is pulling away from football as the professional lacrosse league takes off because of youth participation. And I commend you on your investment in that. Then that is going to pull people away from the NFL, which makes it smart that they're attacking international markets as well to just keep growing this force that is the NFL. And it's one of those things where it's so popular and has been for so long, and it becomes a father-son thing, and people will continue to renew their season tickets. But when you look at it long-term, you know, they're just going to have to be very questionable with the health of the league. I love that conversation a lot. When you look at – I'm a big fan of pickleball. I'll say that on the front end. When you look at the future of pickleball, and you have all of these different leagues right now, they likely – I'm going to give you my point, my kind of viewpoints, and I'll let you pick them apart. You got like three professional leagues right now. Those likely go to one. The franchises went from 100 grand to a million really quick. Mm-hmm. And to me, it seems like they need to really consolidate. And as participation in the sport keeps going up, yes, the viewership will be there, but is it full? Is it truly an entertaining enough sport to really get on the major networks and make some big money?
So this is my personal opinion, right? I don't enjoy watching it that much, right? I think it's fun to play. It's good to get outdoors. It's inclusive. It's easier than tennis. You can get more people involved, older ages, etc. I just don't think, especially high level pickleball. Right? Like it's like, you're basically just like pattying it back and forth. Right. And it's extremely entertaining to play, but I just think it's going to have a difficult time catching millions of fans. But I would say on the flip side of that, it doesn't need that to be successful. So you just talked about it there for a second. I know a bunch of people, I was actually approached very early on to invest in one of the teams, and they wanted me and my brothers and another investor to buy one of the teams. And I think we were approached when it was, you know, 400,000 or 500,000. So kind of in between where it is today. But a lot of the names that you're seeing invest in these teams, it's not that risky of an investment, right? Like right. They're investing seven figures a year as it is. And basically what they're doing is they're using their name or status or celebrity platform to drive popularity to the sport, which I think is good. But for them to be successful, they don't need the teams to be the Dallas Cowboys or the Yankees. They don't need even, you know, a $2 billion franchise. They don't need a $1 billion franchise. If that thing is worth $10 million, they're making a lot of money, right? If it's worth $15 million, you're making a lot of money. So the thing I always tell people is, you know, most people say, hey, look, LeBron owns a team. Kevin Durant owns a team. Gary Vaynerchuk owns a team. All these guys are so into it. And I'm like, yeah, but it's really not that big of an investment for them. They can make a lot of money even if it goes moderately well. There's a lot of, like when you asked earlier about investing and what I look for, the number one thing that I look for is asymmetric upside. And what I mean by that is the biggest opportunity possible. So things that people think are crazy. And that's honestly what got me interested in Bitcoin years ago was that I was like, hey, maybe there's an outside chance this works. It sounds interesting, but if it does work, it's going to be insane, right? And people argue if it worked or not, but the point remains true, which is that you're basically looking for the opportunities that prevent the most upside with limited downside, right? In investing, your downside is zero. Your money goes away. So if you're willing to risk $100,000 or some of these guys, maybe $200,000 or whatever it is, and it can become 10 million or 20 million, and there's a decent probability that that can happen, it makes a lot of sense from an investing perspective, whether you like the sport or not. So my whole thing with it is I think it's popular. I think they're building out a lot of infrastructure for the sport to become more popular with courts and clubs and stuff like that. I think it's to be determined if they'll get the viewership though. And as you know, these leagues don't make a lot of money from sponsorships or ticket sales and stuff like that. It's all media rights, even at the high level. That's where these leagues make the majority of their money. So I think that's ultimately going to be the deciding factor if they can attract enough people to watch.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When you look at LIV Golf, do they have a sustainable model right now?
No, but I don't know if that matters. Right. Right? Like, it's just not. They don't make any money and they spend over $1 billion already. So I don't think that it is sustainable to do that. Obviously not, right? Even if you're Saudi Arabia and you have the sovereign wealth fund that's the second or third largest in the world and all these assets, they're going to want to profit at some point, right? If you don't make enough progress, if you don't have enough good enough players, if you don't get the viewership, like the plug gets pulled eventually. So I would say that I'm on the team wait and see still, right? Like whether you think it's a good idea or not, it's undeniable that it's been good for the PGA and golf in general, right? Because prizes have gone up. They've innovated the product a little bit. The tournaments are changing, the fields are changing and so forth. So as a fan of golf, I'm happy with that. And that's what happens when you introduce competition into the marketplace. So as a golf fan, I think it's been beneficial to the sport as a whole. Obviously you wish some players were still on tour and doing certain things, but time will tell. I think what we'll see is, you know, if they don't get the viewers, then the plug will eventually be pulled. If they do, then it'll be a competing tour and they'll eventually have to get along with each other. But on that, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, the product is just doesn't. Maybe it's just my familiarity with the PGA Tour and my familiarity with turning on CBS or the Golf Channel or whoever is broadcasting it. Just the entertainment value of the LIV Tour, even though I want to watch some of those guys, just hasn't quite been there for me. I have a couple quick questions for you, and I'll get you out of here. What's your favorite restaurant down in Miami?
Ooh, Mandolin. I don't know if anyone listening has been there, but it's a Greek restaurant in the Design District. I don't think I go every week, but me and my wife probably go at least every other week. It's delicious. And we enjoy it a lot.
I'm gonna have to check that out next time I'm down that way. What role does your faith play in your life?
So I grew up, Catholic. I can't say that it plays a huge role today. I think that over time, as I've gotten older, I've understood it better and why it is important. But it's certainly something that I'm constantly striving to make a bigger part of my life and a cornerstone of my life, because as you get older, you see things come and go, right? You understand that life is short, things happen for a reason, people are brought into your life for specific reasons. And faith, I think, is a big part of that. So it's certainly something that I've become more in tune with as I've gotten older. When you're younger, you know, I went to a Catholic school, and you're basically just doing it because that's what you're told to do.
So did I.
Yeah. So it's like my parents, you know, were obviously proponents of it, and we went to church and we did all that stuff. But as you get older, I think it's important to really sit back and realize why you're doing it and how important it really is to you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. All right, last one for me. This is What's Next with Eric Wood. What's next for Joe Pompliano? What do you have coming down the line for you?
So I have a few different things from a content perspective. My whole thing is I always want to end each year with something different, right? I think things need to be constantly growing and changing and improving. And, you know, you can keep doing exactly what you're doing day after day after day and have tremendous success and just build upon one and the other. But I always want to be improving, whether it's from a content side, an investing side, a relationship side, a family side, a friend side, whatever it is. So I certainly have placed a premium on some of the latter parts of that recently, of just trying to stay connected with people and build relationships and do that stuff. But then from a business side, I think there's an amazing opportunity right now to continue doing what I'm doing, but just doing it better and investing in resources and employees and the process. So it's an exciting time to be working on this type of stuff, and media is wide open right now. So I am going to keep doing what I'm doing, but hopefully just better.
Well, I appreciate that. I look forward to seeing that coming down the line. For all those listening, subscribe to Huddle Up, follow Joe on Twitter, Instagram, on all the social platforms, and check out his podcast, The Joe Pomp Show. We reference the Troy Aikman episode, but they range from maybe 10 minutes to an hour, depending on if there's a guest or not, but everything is interesting, and you'll get a huge kick out of that. Joe, I can't thank you enough for your time. I know your days are extremely busy building this brand, building everything you have going on, the investment. So I truly appreciate the time, your words you shared. There are so many nuggets of wisdom in there. I just really appreciate it today.
I enjoyed it, man. I always got time for you, Eric. So thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun, and I appreciate it.
Yep. Absolutely, brother.